Tonight I'm going to do an overview of the Buddha's teaching on how to deal with obsessive thoughts. So if you've never had an obsessive thought in your life, you might just want to listen in case you ever have one. But for those of you have ever been plagued with worry, fear, anxiety, concern, doubt, plaguing memories, worries about what's going to become of me. Of the main types of unskillful thoughts, I could put them into very simple categories. Generally, they either have to do with, the Buddha said, sakkaya ditti, views of self, as in, what do other people think about me? What's going to happen to me? Who am I really? Or B, thoughts that are not about what's happening in the present, future-oriented thoughts, such as what exactly is my life going to look like years from now, etc. There's nothing wrong with having goals or aims at all. There's nothing wrong with wanting to be happy, wanting the people around you to be happy, wanting to achieve something. None of that there's anything unskillful about. But sitting inside of fantasies, trying to picture exactly what that's going to look like, instead of trying to be aware of what we're doing right here and right now to make our futures better, that's when we become unskillful. So again, there's nothing wrong with wanting to be happy in the future, wanting to achieve something. But that is implemented right here and right now. It's not something that occurs by trying to figure out exactly what our life is going to be like 10 or 20 years from now. So, obsessive thoughts. The first thing about obsessive thoughts is that they work in many ways. Most of us sort of, I think, work under the idea that our obsessive thoughts only are ideas in our heads that are repeating over and over again, and they sort of drive us nuts. Just the sheer repetition of those ideas or words or thoughts in our head. And actually, there's many different forms that an obsessive thought can take. It can be obviously a repetitive thought, what the Buddha often called a habitually ingrained thought, anusaya in Pali. But then it also can be a thought that is split into a thousand little variations. Each variation we think of being a separate thought, and we don't realize that we're actually in the guise of an obsession. For example, we might have a big event coming up in the future. We might be graduating from school. We might be tired of our job and needing to get a new job. We might be getting married. We might be buying a house, and all these different thoughts will, or papancha, the Buddha's word, a thousand thoughts will spring forth trying to figure out what it all means. And so we think, well, these are not obsessions, but actually, generally, they're all given birth to by the same energy that is feeling I'm not going to be comfortable and taken care of unless I figure out exactly what's going to happen in my future. Then, on top of that, there's also, when the mind's obsessed, it does something, tamayata, where it fixates on a single part, like a thought, or might be it fixates on an image, or it might fixate on a sound, but every other sensation disappears. Our minds become contracted and claustrophobic. They feel smaller. When we're in a claustrophobic thought, we don't hear what's going on around us. We don't feel what's the sensations of what we're sitting on. We don't feel our breath. And so the rest of the body starts contracting, and the breath changes because we're totally basically walling off the rest of the world and shrinking into this very small area. There's an old saying that I've used this before, but if our minds are only this big, the size of this bowl, then a thought can make a lot of noise. But if our minds are the size of this room, well, this thought can't make a lot of noise. So generally, our thoughts start to make us suffer when our minds become contracted around them, when we are not aware of what's going on around us, what's happening in the present moment. Of course, on top of that, there's the breath of the body. When we are obsessed about something, our bodies become very, very tight, or at least one part. We all hold our stress in one or two or three parts of the body. In my case, it's generally the stomach. When I'm worried about something, my stomach will almost invariably tighten up like a board. Some people I know will develop a knot in their throat, or their shoulders will start moving up above their ears, or their jaws will start moving, or their shoulder blades will contract. Or you all have your areas, and you've probably in the past at some point stumbled upon this way that your body lets you know that it's unhappy. Or it's not so much only your body, it's really the way that our unconscious speaks to us. There's a part of the mind, the limbic system, which primarily lets us know what it's feeling, positive or negative, by contracting the body. Then on top of it, there's the pace of your breath. When we're upset, when we're in a panic attack, we start doing what's known as rapid, shallow breathing. We breathe very fast and very, very shallow. What happens when we're in a panic attack is because we're breathing rapidly and shallowly, we're not oxygenating, and we become dizzy. And so when people are having panic attacks, they literally can feel lightheaded and dizzy and really uncomfortable because they don't realize that they're not ventilating correctly. They're hyperventilating. So these are some of the many different ways that obsessions can take over our experience. Again, it's not just a repeating thought. It's actually basically a mental event that's happening on, and a physical event. It's happening on many different fields at the same time. There's the thought itself, the mind's awareness, the body and its feelings, the perceptions and the breath. So these are what the Buddha called the components, the aggregates, the khandhas. Many different elements having at the same time. Now, most of us, when we're obsessed, we only know one way to deal with obsessive thoughts, which is we argue with them. If we're frightened of something that's going to happen in the future, like we hate our jobs and we want to quit our jobs, so the thought, I've got to quit my job, I hate this job, I don't like these people, I don't want to go to that place anymore, it's Sunday night, I can't believe I have to go to work again, why do I have to do this? And then there's another part of our brain which thinks the only way to deal with this obsession is to argue with it. Well, I need to go to this job because I have to pay the rent. And even though those people are terrible, I probably won't find another job anywhere else because I'm a fraud and I really don't have any talents. I just happen to have landed into this lucky job and I really should feel grateful that I have it, blah, 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 blah. We all have this debate between often two equally low-blowing lawyers in our head that will never quit. And there's never a official verdict in our brain. Every single time we come to a conclusion when we deal with obsession in these ways, there's always another trial. It's always taken up to another court in our head. We might, on Monday morning, trudge off to work deciding that we need to pay the rent, but still that voice will appeal to the next highest court in our mind saying, no, I really hate this job. I really hate these people. I don't like what I'm doing. I really should have listened to my mom when she said I should have blah, 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 blah. And then the other voices come in, no, you'll never be hired again. You have no skills, blah, blah, blah. And back and forth and back and forth. So, there are other ways to deal with obsessive thoughts other than arguing with them. The Buddha had a wonderful teaching, which is what I'm giving tonight, called the Vitakka Sandana, which is, vitakka is the Buddha's, the Pali word for thoughts, and santhana, santhana means to get rid of or to cease. So the meaning of that word means how to get rid of your thoughts. And I think it's just great that a spiritual figure 2,500 years ago took the time in front of a bunch of monks to say, today I'm going to tell you how to get rid of your thoughts. Which I think all of us can learn from. So it's good that we have five additional ways to work with thoughts. Four out of these I use all the time. The last one, when we get to it, I rarely use, but it's worth noting. I think you'll find it equally, maybe you'll use it a lot. I don't know. I haven't met too many people who use the last method, but the first four I think are invaluable. So, starting with the very first method of the five, the first is replace the thought that causes stress or suffering with a thought or something to focus on that doesn't cause stress or suffering. Now, that might sound very obvious, but there's actually a lot of extremely wise cognitive therapists, cognitive behavioral therapists, mindfulness-based therapists, dialectical behavioral therapists who make a very good living doing and teaching you the exact same thing, which is simply begin to notice what kinds of thoughts you have that cause papancha or multiplication in your mind or stress physically in your body or keep you glued to them and you have no control over them. Begin to notice which thoughts repeat over and over again or split up into 1,000 similar forms. Begin to notice your body gets tight or your breath changes. Start noticing when you're in a stressful thought or an obsessive thought. And then find a thought that will not cause stress. Now, the Buddha didn't end there. He said that we should find an appropriate thought that will counterbalance whatever kind of suffering thought we're in. So I'll give you an example. Suppose we are in anger with somebody. We're furious with somebody. We feel like we've been mistreated. The Buddha said the best thing to do in that situation is go to the spiritually opposite place and to practice forgiveness or goodwill for that person. So if you're angry with that person, see if you can cultivate a sense of forgiveness for them. Reflect on something unskillful that you've done that's similar to whatever you're furious with them about. Reflect on how we all make mistakes. You can reflect on how everybody lives in the results of their actions, so we don't need to put them through any more suffering. Or you can simply reflect on the fact that being angry with someone feels shitty. It doesn't feel good. But if you actually can move your mind to a place of forgiveness, that actually physically relaxes you. It actually makes the mind calmer. It makes it easier for the mind to feel more spacious. Simply the thought of sending goodwill or forgiveness to somebody who causes us anger. I used to do this with Dick Cheney day after day after day. Just practicing that one skill can actually, believe me, Dick Cheney is not going to get out of the hell realms to which he is heading for because I've forgotten him. I'm not that powerful. Neither are you. The fact that I've forgiven somebody doesn't get them out of the karma of what they've done. All it means is I don't have to suffer for what they've done. The worst thing we can do to ourselves when somebody has acted unskillfully to us is compound the problem by thinking about them a lot. And yet we do that all the time. When we're angry or disappointed, we double the suffering by reviewing it over and over and over and over and over in our heads, making it worse and worse for ourselves. They're not aware that we're doing this or all the mean things that we're thinking about them. Indeed, we're not that powerful either. So, when we're feeling angry or disappointed or frustrated with someone, the best things to cultivate is the spiritual opposite, a sense of forgiveness or sending them goodwill. Simply, may they be happy. May they find true peace. Finding happiness simply means that they find it within, not by acting idiotically to other people. If we are in a state of craving, where we really want something, the Buddha said we should practice the idea of letting go. What would it be like to let go of this thing? Sometimes, for example, when I've been really upset with the fact that I don't have something, and I just say, well, what would it be like if I just allow myself not to have this thing? Whatever it is. What would it be like if I just give up? Just that feeling of letting go, giving up, is so relaxing. Sometimes people who are in relationships that are not working out, and they so want to be in a relationship with this one person, and they're so craving it. And the idea of letting go, saying, well, what would it be just like to assume that I'm not in it, and it's over, and it's gone? And that idea sounds scary. But when we actually do get to that place of letting go, that place of giving ourselves permission to say we can have a good life without whatever it is we've been fixating on, that feeling of letting go can be so relaxing, so physically relaxing. Then, if we're in a place of envy, if we really feel that somebody has gotten something we want, the Buddha said, practice or cultivate appreciation. Appreciation for the fact that they're happy. Now, this sounds awkward. In fact, mudita, what it's called, is one of the most difficult mental states to develop. But when we can really, truly, one of my favorite quotes of the Dalai Lama is if we can feel happy when somebody else is happy, our chances of happiness go up by 8 billion or 6 billion because there's 6 billion people on the planet. If we can only feel happy when something good happens to us, well, we've reduced our chances of happiness by 6 billion. You do the math. It's better to be able to feel a sense of happiness when somebody else has done something or achieved something. Now, if you can't do that, and it's okay if you can't, the next thing to practice is gratitude, which the Buddha said is an extremely worthy state. And gratitude is simply reflecting on all of the skillful actions that we've done recently. It can simply be that you've gone to Dharma punks and you've meditated, or that you called up somebody, or that you did something skillful when you normally would have done something unskillful, or out of virtue, you have not acted out on an impulse. One of my favorite teachings is that if somebody offered me $1 million to kill someone, I would not do it, which means that I have something worth more than $1 million. In fact, I have something worth more than $10 billion because I wouldn't take any money ever to kill anyone. So I actually carry something with me, a virtue, that is priceless. And that's something to reflect on. Every time we act out of a sense of virtue, every time we let go of an action that other people would take that's unskillful, that's something to reflect on. We shouldn't be sparse with our sense of rewarding ourselves with gratitude. Sometimes in life I see people who are in the beginnings of their spiritual path, and the first thing they do when they do something nice for another person is they have to find somebody to tell. I walked that old woman across the street. And so what we're doing is we're making our sense of happiness contingent upon finding somebody and them appreciating us. But if we can truly develop this practice of rewarding ourselves for our own goodness, then our happiness is not contingent upon somebody recognizing it. We can reward ourselves that way. Sometimes, this is why we meditate, by the way. One of the chief reasons why we meditate. It's taking the mind from the normal stressful thoughts that we carry around, you know, with us all day. What's going to happen when I get married, when I get a job, when I move my apartment, when I blah, blah, blah. What's going to happen which is inherently going to be a stressful thought, and we time and again bring the awareness back to relaxing the body in the present time. This practice of moving the mind away from what I call the junk food it likes to chew on to the health food of skillful thoughts and actions that will bring us long-term happiness. Now, the mind doesn't like health food. It likes junk thoughts. It wants to really figure out exactly everything that's going to happen in the future, even though we have no possible way of doing that. So practicing eating health thoughts, training the mind to eat healthy things or consume healthy thoughts and perceptions takes a lot of practice. Again, the way this starts is noticing when we're obsessing, figuring out what kind of obsession it is. Is it anger? Is it frustration? Jealousy? Am I being hard on myself? If I'm hard on myself, then I need to practice compassion. And then whatever it is I'm doing, find a spiritual thought that I can develop and cultivate that will relax the body. You can tell if you found such a thought because when you think it, your body will start to relax. That place in your body where you hold your fear and your worry will start to relax. That's why at the end of each Dharma Punks, we quickly do the Brahma Viharas meditations, the goodwill, meditations. So we can experience just how thinking a skillful thought relaxes the body and relaxes the mind. Okay, that's the first technique, replacing the thoughts. The second technique is reflecting on the thought, stepping away from it and asking ourselves, if we thought this way all the time, would it be a good idea or a bad idea? Or another question to ask, would I allow anyone else in the world to tell me what this thought is telling me? Imagine this thought you're telling yourself in coming out of somebody else's mouth. Would you allow somebody else to follow you around and say, hey, you idiot, you failure, I can't believe you're still at this place in your life. You should be doing so much better than you. No, you wouldn't let anybody else do that. Or you can do another test. Would you say that thought to another person that you cared about? Or even, frankly, to anyone else? Most of us will say things to ourselves that we would never, ever, ever say to another human being. So give yourself those tests. Choose one. And simply with each thought, ask yourself, is this something I would ever say to another human being? Is it compassionate? And if it's not, then that thought has failed the test. Which brings us to number three. Number three is when a thought has failed the test, when it's something you would never say to another human being, or you would never let another human being say to you, or it's not a thought that you would feel comfortable thinking all the time, then treat it the way you would a madman on the street. You don't stop and argue with them. You don't sit and listen to them. You don't invite them into your house. You don't encourage them. You keep on walking. The Buddha said, he used a great analogy for each of these. He uses an analogy for replacing thoughts. He said, imagine you're hitting one peg out of a piece of wood with another peg. That's replacing thoughts. And with the second one, he said, cultivate the same horror of the thought that you would if you saw a carcass of an animal. You know, when you see a dead pigeon or something like that, you cultivate the same sense that, oh my God. And then he said, treat the thought like it's a mad person. That it's literally somebody that you're not going to beat up a mad person. You're not going to even get angry at the mad person. They're mad after all, right? You're not going to pick a fight with them. You're not going to, though, debate with them. There's this one guy in my neighborhood on Bedford who every night is out there. He's probably, I guess, around 50, and he's out there screaming, specifically at the woman. For those who live in Williamsburg know this guy. And every single night, there's a different person arguing with him. He's never going to change that tune. That's what our thoughts are like. Every day, they they're there, they're waiting. You know, when you wake up, you're like, oh, well, nice night's sleep, and they're up there. Well, we've got an agenda for you today. First of all, you know, you suck. And you're like, oh. They're not going to suddenly grow up. So this idea that we can change this tape recording in our mind by arguing with it is something that we've cultivated, but we never actually win with it. It's something that I think we practice in the real world. We try to argue with people, so we think we can argue with those tape recordings in our head, but it doesn't work. The much better way is to replace them if they're unskillful, or ask ourselves, would we ever say this to another human being or allow another human being to say this to us? If we wouldn't, then we reject them like we would a mad person. Now, the fourth technique is my favorite, which is learn to find the area in your body that gets tight when you're obsessed or when you're worrying or when you're panicking. Find that area, and over time, learn how you can relax it. It's actually a great, scientifically sound observation that if you relax the somatic experience, your mind will relax with it. This is actually going to be part of the foundation of what I'm going to be talking about next week, the Satipatthana, or the mindfulness teachings. But basically, the Buddha made the observation, which was seconded by neuroscientists like Antonio Damasio, 2,500 years after him, that every thought and every single state has a physical component to it. The body is always at the level of, by clenching, tightening, the hormones that are released by the amygdala and the limbic system is tightening and relaxing with each thought and each experience that we're going through. And if we can learn to undercut the foundation of the thought, which is the body, the thought will relax as well. It's a way around the thought. Instead of engaging the thought at all, we simply create an environment where stressful thoughts can't even live. We relax the body. If the body is relaxed, the mind will relax too. A stressful, contracted mind is dependent upon a stressful body. If we relax the body, also what we're doing is expanding the awareness so we're no longer attached or trapped by the thought. We're no longer carried away by what we're obsessing about. So, please, if there's any of these five techniques that you develop, that you cultivate, I would urge it to be this one and the replacing of the thoughts. Start to get to know your body. When you're obsessing, when you're worrying, start to notice what part of your body gets tight. Start working with your breath. Start sending yourself, may I be happy, may I be peaceful thoughts to this part of your body that gets tight, so that when you're upset, you can relax the body. The good news is that if you do this practice first in your meditation when you're not obsessing, then you can take the techniques that you've been developing, and when you are really suffering about something, you'll have in place the tools that will be there to make your work much easier. If you wait until you've got a possible cancer diagnosis, that's not the time. Your mind's not going to shut down. I guarantee you. If suddenly out of the blue you get fired or you get dumped by a long-term relationship or something in life triggers you, or just a asava, a underlying emotional impulse raises up and takes over your mind, and we wait until these points to try to deal with obsession, we're in trouble. That's why we meditate, because we practice bringing the mind time and time again away from what it wants to chew on to something that won't cause stress. That's why we do this work. Finally, the Buddha said, and this is the one I often find the most humorous, I've only done this technique once in a while. Buddha said, I have to quote him here, if unskillful thoughts continue to arise, then with teeth clenched and tongue pressed firmly against the roof of the mouth, one should beat down and destroy the unskillful parts of the mind with the skillful parts. What this basically means is that if everything else fails and you find you're going to do something really stupid, it's 4 o'clock in the morning and you're going to call your ex, or you're about to send that email to your boss, or you can tell that something is just not right, but you still want to do it, then literally, if relaxing the body still hasn't worked, and if knowing that this thought you wouldn't tell to your worst enemy, and still if you can't replace the thought, and still if you can't treat it like a mad person, and you still want to do it, well then, do something physical and bite down and just say over and over again, get the fuck away from me. Now, I have actually had to do this once in a great while. There have been times when I just really wanted to click the send button, and the only thing that stands in between me and it is just, you know, clenching my teeth for a second and really physicalizing it so that I'm not trapped by the thought, so I have a moment to get away. Then I recommend breathing, relaxing, and going back over the first 4. I don't necessarily think that walking around with your teeth clenched and the tongue pressed against the roof of the mouth is a particularly skillful technique. And many monks I've studied with say that this 5th technique is really to be used in the event of thoughts that are going to cause you long-term suffering. In other words, if you act out on something that's irreparable, that's when you do the 5th. But the 4th, and they all start, you can remember them with the R's that I make up, and they're all terrible, but replace, reflect, reject, and relax. So replace the thoughts with something skillful. Reflect, if you'd even allow anybody else to say them to you, if you'd ever say them to anyone else. Reject them, like they're a mad person. Just learn to walk by them. Don't argue. Don't invite them in. And relax. Relax the body. Relax the breath. If you can do those 4, I think you'll have 4 more tools to deal with your thoughts than the normal way, which is simply arguing with.